It is Saturday, April 16th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. in the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments about technology. When you call in, I'll give those numbers at the midpoint of the show. It's time now for Geek Speak. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet. Cruise.io powers broadband DSL and websites for thousands of local homes and businesses. Cruise.io Internet, technology for the next 20 years. More information online at cruise.io.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. In the air room with me, I have Lindsay Lonnie, system analyst.
Good morning, Miles.
And I don't have you powdered up. Which mic are you on? You just look beyond three. Let's try that out.
Number
now.
Three.
Yes.
Good morning, Miles.
And I have someone else in the air room who refused to be on air, so we'll just leave it at that. So, let's begin the news. Lindsay.
All right. Google has backed a project aiming to teach computers regret. At least that's what the headline says. I think they're using the word regret a little bit liberally. But a group of researchers at Tel Aviv University in Israel are working on technology that will teach computers to feel regret for bad decisions. The aim is to enable artificial intelligence to manage the decision-making process when they're presented with choices and then remember logically whether or not the choice ended in success or failure. But the additional part, which... You know, the goal is to give AIs the ability to learn from their experiences and then use that knowledge to inform new and different decisions that don't have to do with the same items, even if they're unrelated to whatever they've already seen. So that's the new part of it and why the research is getting funded. Of course, regret's a little bit of a misnomer since the goal isn't to make them feel anything so much as just learn from mistakes and minimize the probability of making unsuccessful or, you know, inefficient choices again in the future.
Sounds like they're being trained to be CEOs.
Yeah, exactly. They're hoping that it'll prove... So the reason Google's putting funding into it is because they're hoping that this kind of technology can improve their AdWords and AdSense advertising products by making it faster to make good choices about what advertisements to show people and stuff like that on the pages. You know, they're also, the researcher are also developing decision technology like this to improve other areas of computing, like network management systems, you know, for routing and prioritizing traffic on the internet and, you know, corporate networks like load balancing systems and stuff like that.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And speaking of, well, absolutely nothing about what you talked about.
Yes,
but,
that.
My first story of the day has to do with something that hits a little too close to home with regard to power usage. One of the things that has been a kick for me lately is how do I reduce the amount of power being used by my electrical equipment? I've been trying to set up a server on a netbook, so something that's very low power usage.
I'd like to hear how that goes.
Well, I mean, it's working. It's not like even a netbook today is noticeably more powerful than the most powerful server 20 years ago.
Right.
Just to give a point of context, like it's amazing that, you know, people were paying $5,000 for a 16 megabyte RAM 386, you know, or maybe a little bit more than that, but
Yeah, for $400, yeah. I could buy a tiny laptop.
Less than that. I mean, I got mine for $185.
Nice.
It's a 9-inch, you know, screen. But then again, if I'm using it as a server, having a small screen is a good thing.
What about the applications that you run? Because, of course, the stuff we run now is more, hogs more resources.
I'm running a Ubuntu server on it.
Excellent. Okay.
So, I mean, it's...
Yay, Ubuntu. All right.
And the thing is, a netbook, even today, like my netbook came standard with 1 gig of RAM. I mean, 1 gigabyte of RAM.
That's standard on a tiny little under $100, $200 netbook. Yeah.
Well, it was refurbished, but then again, hey, it's... the reason I bring this up is because all of the power that my laptop or anybody's laptop is using throughout the entire lifetime of that laptop, no matter how efficient it is, or even if it's inefficient, I should say, pales in comparison to the amount of energy required to make that laptop in the first place.
Really?
So a study that was done recently was showing that as much as 70% of the energy a typical laptop will consume during its lifetime is used during the manufacture of it. Only 30% is the time spent charging up the battery and having it plugged in into your house when you're actually using it.
So by the time I've purchased a new machine, 70% of, whatever resources it's going to hog have already been hogged.
Right.
And the best hope that I have to save resources is in that remaining 30% somewhere.
Right. That and the best hope would be, well, the thing is, it's not necessarily a horrible thing, because one of the reasons why it's such a small percentage is because the computers are using so much less energy than they were previously. They are becoming more efficient. So it's going to become probably even a smaller and smaller proportion of that. But it seems like the big win now, the low-hanging fruit, is not in getting a more efficient device. It's working with companies that are making their processes more efficient.
Right, more efficient manufacturing. Shipping, all that good stuff. Yeah,
unfortunately, I don't know of an easy way to find that information out. Most companies don't say, and by the way, this is how much energy we're using when we're making your Dell laptop or your HP laptop or your MacBook Pro.
Yeah, and a lot of them are manufactured and assembled overseas, and so there's probably more difficulty getting studies done. Interesting. So that might be a good branch for somebody to get into.
It'd definitely be a marketing area, as long as people understand that most of that energy is being used. And so anyone who has not listened to this show, doesn't listen to it regularly, all you podcasters out there, make sure you have a friend come out there and,
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and the industry we're in, that makes it hard, because it doesn't give us a lot of room to do something about it unless we change into our industry, into manufacturing studies. But at least the machines are more efficient.
Yes, at least the machines are more efficient. So we're down to earth, we're down to brass tacks. Let's put our heads back up into the clouds a little bit, Lindsay.
All right. So I was talking a while back about, NASA and retiring the space shuttles and the fact that a bunch of museums are trying to get the shuttles after they're retired. And NASA finally came to a decision. Since 2008, 21 museums across the country placed bids to get their very own space shuttle. The museums will have they have to have climate-controlled indoor display for it, though. They can't put it outside, because there was an experience where one museum put one outside and it became really weathered. So they also have to have the ability to accommodate a shuttle delivery on the back of a Boeing 747, and they have to be able to afford the estimated $28 million needed to prepare a safe display.
To provide a safe display, safe for the shuttle or safe for the people looking at the shuttle?
Probably just safe for the shuttle, but okay. I'm guessing they're probably going to also want it safe for the people looking at the shuttle. Yeah, that's just
guess. Whatever. Those people.
Watch out for the shuttle. Yeah, exactly. So as of the 12th, the decisions were announced by NASA. The oldest and most flown spacecraft, the Discovery, was already promised to the Smithsonian Institute. So,
which makes sense. They seem to always get the best stuff.
Right. And if you've been to the museums, I mean, it's like a religious experience for a geek.
Yeah. Well, I was recently there with my girlfriend. What was that now? 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And yes, I totally wholeheartedly agree. There's just so much stuff there. The Smithsonian isn't just this one building, just so people who haven't been there before understand. It's half the mall. In D.C. So take the people are used to seeing the reflecting pool in between Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. If you go the other side, which is the Washington Monument to the Capitol building, that entire area is lined by museums that are all known collectively as the Smithsonian Institution.
Right. And there's just amazing stuff. I could spend weeks and weeks there just looking at the Smithsonian stuff. And when I was there, I didn't even get to go to the big space museum that's out by Dulles Airport. I just went to the one that's right in the city. And the one that's out by Dulles Airport is going to be the one that gets the shuttle.
Okay. And that makes sense because the shuttle is kind of big.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to put that somewhere in town might be a little difficult. But so what's going to happen is they currently have one of the older shuttles that was actually just an Explorer shuttle, the Enterprise. And so they're going to give the Enterprise to a museum in New York so that they can make room for, you know, this one, the Discovery.
Yeah, is that museum going to also put little mock-ups of the NCC-1701 A, B, C, and D, you know, off to the side of it?
We will find out. I don't know. So there's two other shuttles, the Endeavour, which is launching its final mission later this month, and then that's going to head over to the California Science Center in L.A. And it was that's only a few miles from where the shuttle was developed, so that's probably one of the reasons they chose that for the Endeavour. And then in 2 months, the Atlantis will be launching the 135th and last mission of NASA's shuttle program. And then after that, that will be retired and staying at the Kennedy Space Center. So,
yeah. And a moment of reflection on the brave men and women who lost their lives on the other two shuttles, the Columbia and the Challenger.
Yep. Thanks to the explorers.
Thanks to the explorers. And speaking of explorers and speaking of space, we have a story about a high school that was based in Las Vegas where you have a group taking photographs of near space photography or taking near space photography, practicing near space photography, taking photos of near space. Near space being a very low Earth orbit. You're at the outer edges of the Earth's atmosphere. You're able to see the full curvature of the Earth. You're able to see, you know, that horizon line very clearly. What makes this very interesting, however, is that they were able to do it on a very, very tight budget. And when I say a tight budget, I mean less than $60.
Wow.
Which, not only being a cool set of photos, which I highly recommend, and we'll be putting all these stories up on geekspeak.org after the show is over, but the fact that it is now within reach of the average person. The average person, and you want to take some photos of, you know, space.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just for NASA anymore. It's not just for, you know, big companies or folks with with a full rocket complement or the ability to pay hundreds of dollars per pound in payload to get things up there. It's actually in the hobbyist range.
Yeah, it's something that you could go out and, you know, do with your kids, you know, to show them how to launch a mini satellite almost. I thought it was neat that they used a lot of, begged and borrowed stuff, mm-hmm. like the container, the cooler that they used, which is one of those soft, I think it was like a lunch or six-pack container kind of thing.
Right.
You know, they just got it at the Lost the
ones
and Found
with,
at the
with
school.
With like a little Mylar lining.
Yeah, and they found that it actually decreased damage to the equipment on the fall because of its cushiness mm-hmm. as opposed to the hard coolers. And their website is pretty fun.
So, moving on, I guess we can't leave space just yet.
Oh, really?
Well, let's go into fantasy anyway. Let's do a little crossover.
A little crossover. Well, it's been a while since there was an American monument built for everybody. You know, we've got stuff in New York, we've got all kinds of great monuments, but it's been a while since something new was done. And then one ambitious geek is rallying the rest of us, putting out a war cry to come up with a way to build a fully functional, full-scale AT-AT from Star Wars that could be a touring American monument.
An AT-AT. So, explain again, just to remind some of the audience that, you know, it sees the sun a little bit more often, what an AT-AT is.
I'm not really sure how to describe it, and other than it's a four-legged mobile assault vehicle. Do you have a better description for what an AT-AT is? It's actually moving. It looks somewhat like a dog, I think.
I am really gonna,
but it's huge.
Out myself as how big a geek I am. All-terrain armored transport, mm-hmm. first seen in the movie The Empire Strikes Back. And was the design of it was based upon the dock cranes found in the Bay Area near Oakland Harbor.
Ooh, I didn't even know that.
I think it was Oakland Harbor, something like that, where if you look out, if you're driving along 880 and you look out toward the bay, you'll see these construction cranes, loading cranes, basically. And you'll get the idea of where George Lucas got his inspiration for the AT-AT vehicles that would show up in his movies later on.
That's really neat. I didn't know that was the inspiration for that. Yeah, so he's got a really moving request out there on the website, yeah. And he's already brought
it up. Pun
intended?
Or does it actually move?
Yeah, they're hoping that it can move and be mobile, go coast to coast, you know, touring the country, strolling around through cornfields in the Midwest and watching the coast in New York City.
I, for one, welcome our Empire Strikes Back inspired all-terrain armored transport overlords.
Me too. And the guy that started this said that he's already bounced it off of minds like Adam Savage from Mythbusters, Mark Fraunfelder, Boing Boing and Make, Ken Danmeade of Geek Dad, and, you know, everyone agrees it needs to happen. And so they're trying to get people to sign up with ideas. And, of course, the person that came up with this, he's like, I don't have any money to do this, and I don't have any technical skills, but let's get this done. He's like, there's got to be some people out there that are willing to work on it. And from what I've seen, you know, there probably are. There's probably people right now brainstorming. Yep. I can't wait to see it myself.
Okay, so changing gears a little bit, we're still going to stay in the geeky mode. This is Geek Speak after all. We're going to talk about the fact that Comcast is soon to be offering a 105 megabit service.
That's a lot of megabits.
That's a lot of megabits. That's actually bringing it in line with what Japan and South Korea were having in recent years. And, I mean, this is... That speed is the equivalent of high-speed Ethernet, 15 years ago, 100 base T?
Yep.
So the fastest you could have in a local network is now what Comcast is slated to be offering for home internet connections. It's not going to be as cheap as the, you know, 15 megabit that some of us have right now or cheaper or the slower.
And in my opinion, that's already overpriced, but that's just me.
Right, and you will need a new cable modem that can handle those higher speeds.
Right. And I'm sure there's only certain areas that can get it so far.
Certainly. But there is a major, major drawback to this.
Oh, really?
Which is Comcast has been one of the more aggressive companies for throttling the internet connection. In other words, and this has been for people I don't want to say abusing the system, but are definitely using the system to its utmost, who are sharing movies online, and they have setups on their computer where they are downloading 24/7, essentially.
Right.
So not your typical user, not even a person who's watching Netflix every evening. You know, this is someone who is really sucking down that bandwidth. So Comcast has cut down on them and put an actual cap saying, okay, 250 gigabytes per month, which if you have a 10 or 15 gigabit connection, like it's easy to hit that cap if you're downloading all the time. But in general, most users, like 95, 99% of users, don't ever hit that problem. Now, when you talk about a 105 megabit connection, though, that ends up being, oh, well, I want to download something very large. I want to do something experimenting. I want to try this out and get that huge speed. It would take you 5 hours to use up your month allocation.
5 hours?
5 hours. If you were saying, okay, I want to download from a friend of mine, like download from each other, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
You're going to download and you're going to test out the speed and we're just going to, like, you know, see how many libraries of Congress we can download as a unit of measurement.
It's a good benchmark.
After 5 hours of doing so, their caps will come into play. And I don't know what they would do specifically, whether they cut you off or just charge you more that month as a penalty. But at the same time, it seems like if you're raising up that that download speed, wouldn't you also raise the cap?
Yeah. I mean, who's the target audience at that point then? I mean, who needs that kind of speed and wants to pay that much money unless they're doing that kind of P2P stuff?
Or I could see someone who wants to, who does download stuff that isn't necessarily going P2P, but just says like, oh, I want to be able to download CD images of Linux distributions on a regular basis or try mm-hmm. all these different items. There you get into the ability to download in a timely fashion. It opens up new avenues that aren't necessarily illegal,
mm-hmm.
That aren't necessarily, you know, questionable.
Right.
I don't want to say illegal for downloading. Someone who is downloading off of peer-to-peer sites, yes, you are usually violating copyright law. But at the same time, just downloading a whole bunch is running contrary to a company policy, not necessarily illegality. I just wanted to make that
right.
correction there.
Interesting. I wonder how that's going to go if people are going to start, you know, squealing about it and they'll end up raising it. I don't know.
Yeah, so I guess it's for those folks that are web browsing, they want their YouTube to buffer immediately. Like, you don't have to wait at all.
Right.
You go to the site and the video starts playing immediately, and you can go to a different video and it starts playing immediately.
I mean, that would be nice, even for me. You know, I've got Netflix, and sure, it does compression, but I have to buffer. I have to right. wait, you know. So.
But there's also another aspect that just came to mind, which is if you go to a YouTube page, you go to watch a video, you have that short buffer time, and then as you're playing, it's still buffering. And there are a lot of times when I bring up a video and I go, oh, yeah, this is looking dumb. I'm going to close this down. With 105 megabits, as soon as you click on that link, that entire video could probably be streamed and be done and ready to go, even though you only watched the first 5 seconds of it and decided you didn't want to watch it, and it's a minute and a half long video, which means that your bandwidth would go up even though you don't change your habits.
Yeah.
That's an interesting aspect to this.
And maybe a good target audience would be people in multimedia households. Like, say you've got a TV in every room of your house, you've got a big family, everyone's watching Netflix movies, you know, and they're going to be able to do rewind, fast forward, because it only buffers that small percentage. And if
right.
you try to go back to the beginning, it has to buffer again. And then everyone's going to have a good multimedia experience, because now big TVs are coming with that stuff. And so maybe this
right,
is all.
But once you open it up for, you know, three people to watch Netflix simultaneously in different rooms, as opposed to just watching the one, and if you watch two, then things start getting chunky, that type of thing, then that, once again, you're adding up to that. You're hitting that.
Yeah.
You could definitely hit that 250 gigabyte cap much faster if you have multiple people watching Netflix at the same time in parallel different items. Like, it's.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see what happens then.
We'll see what happens. Okay, so I guess we are completely changing gears. What's your next story, Lindsay?
Do you want to talk about Obama's internet ID plan?
Won't be completely changing gears. I'll just be
yeah.
moving in the political sphere.
Yes.
Political sure, go
stuff.
Ahead.
So I'm not really that familiar with this, but I think it's something worth talking about a little bit or touching on. The Obama administration, they've moved forward with this quote-unquote internet ID plan. There's a 55-page document that was released by the White House earlier this week that adds more details to that proposal. And it's still a little unclear what exactly it's asking for. But some of the examples of what it views as an identity ecosystem, including obtaining a digital ID from an internet service provider that could be used to view things like your personal health information, you could have an ID for your cell phone that would let you log into like irs.gov and use it to identify who you are so that people can't log in as you and get, you know, your employment records or whatever. And different things like making payments, filing taxes. And the way it would work is to have multiple identity providers that are part of a same system, but it's all going to be IDs provided by public sector. So government would not be providing the IDs. It would be like an ISP or something like that.
So in terms of the geek sphere, it sounds very much like OpenID. Like,
right.
Anyone can be a provider as long as... Okay.
As long as they're like a, you know, approved certified provider. I don't know. But then who's doing the approving and certifying of the providers, you know?
Probably the government.
The government, yeah. Right. they're going to convene a series of workshops between June and September this year that would bring together companies and advocacy groups in order to move closer to an actual specification for what's being called the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, or NSTIC, NSTIC.
Yeah, civil libertarians have been worried about it simply because this having an internet ID would be absolutely the end of privacy. Mm. There would be a single ID.
That's a strong statement.
Well, I mean, it really would be because you would have that single ID. No matter if you got it from a different providers, each person would have a single ID. Mm-hmm. And if that's going to be your key into your healthcare, your health coverage, key into your daily purchases, key into your ability to file taxes, that ends up being very much every aspect of your life would be easily searchable.
Mm-hmm. What they're talking about sounds like that this idea is going to be used more for like government service related stuff, but it's a little gray. It seems like that's how they're presenting it, but then they're hoping that it's going to end up being more universal, like purchases mm-hmm. and what you're talking yeah. about.
On the flip side, for folks that are worried about issues like immigration or mm-hmm. fraud, things like that, an ID that positively identifies a person is a invaluable tool to be able to say, is this person who they say they are? Is who is
right.
Supposed to be here, who's not? Or one
of the concerns with that, though, is the flip side of that is you become so trusting of something like that that there's still going to be identity theft. It's just going to be much more difficult. And if you're that person that has your identity stolen in an environment where these IDs, everyone has mm-hmm. one, you suddenly, you can't get into your house anymore, or you can't get into, nobody knows who you are. I mean, it would
right.
ruin your life.
Right. It's conceivable that in the future they're going to be integrating this technology with, for example, a cell phone, so that you can make, swipe your phone in front of a kiosk and be able to pay your taxes. And once that happens, it becomes a more sticky problem. Someone steals your phone, and is it a major issue?
Right.
Or it wasn't before. Can they empty your bank account?
Yeah. And so these meetings that they're having are open to the public. But what they're not specifying is whether or not there's going to be any discussion allowed. What the fear is that these meetings are going to be PR to basically sell these ideas to the public and say, no, it's safe, it's fine. So it'll be interesting. I wonder if somebody does end up going to these meetings, if, we could get somebody to report back what their opinion is on that. But
yeah, it does sound very much to me that we have mixed opinions about whether it's a good thing or not. But the bottom line is it would change a lot of things. It's not just someone gets a new ID card and it's just one more thing you put into your wallet. Like, it will change how we interact.
Exactly. Yeah, and it could be great if the point is what happens. But always two sides. Always two sides.
At least two sides.
Yes.
You are listening to Geek Speak on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. The geeks today are Lindsay Lonnie, system analyst.
Hello.
KUSP co-sponsors Lightfoot Industries Supper Club at its new location, Dig Gardens and Design, 420 Water Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Supper clubs will continue through Saturday, May 28th, with one seating on Saturday nights at 6 p.m. The new location brings new chef Kevin Coble to manage the Lightfoot Kitchen with appearances from guest chefs and speakers. Diners will enjoy a pre-dinner cocktail and shop hour, followed by a five-course family-style meal served by Lightfoot teen apprentices. Information at lightfootind.com. So, we're here. This is Geek Speak. I'm your host, Miles Elam, and we're going to be taking calls. The numbers here are 476-2800 or toll-free at 800-655-5877. Or you can email us at or go to our website and send a message to us through our web form. And we should be able to check that as well. And it looks like we have a call already on line one. Is that the case? Yes. Okay. Hello.
Hello, this is Kirkland.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes, you had a thought about the Oakland Cranes?
More than a thought, because I'd thought about it for years myself. And I thought, did those cranes even exist back in the mid-70s, late-70s? Well, I went to the web, of course, and went to a film blog, and a guy was wondering about that as well, and he says, and I quote, "Well, it turns out the San Francisco Chronicle journalist Peter Hartlaub was finally able to ask Lucas about the story, and guess what? Yep, it's completely untrue, just another urban myth."
Oh,
really?
I was spreading false information. Thank you so much for correcting me before it got disseminated too far.
So was there something?
Before you even get to other myths, there was another one that said that it didn't look like a container crane. It looked more like a garbage truck. And they're supposed to be looking like more like big armored vehicles on wheels. So anyway, I want to pass that on. I wondered too.
No, thank you so much. I love getting corrected on air. I'm one of those rare individuals that likes getting corrected
actually. Because
it's masculine. I just hate that. I have a teacher aspect to me, and I just can't stand like the fact that I would have disseminated information without being called on it, and people are going to be repeating that later on down the road.
Right.
I don't blame you. I feel the same way.
Thank you for the call, Kirkland.
Sure thing.
Right, take care. Bye.
So I wonder if there was something that was a motivation for those things, or if it really was a garbage truck. I don't know. Someone will find out and put it up on the website, I'm sure.
And once again, you're listening to Geek Speak. The numbers here are 476-2800 or toll free at 800-655-5877. You can call and ask us about just about everything. We can handle, I guess, Mac, Linux, Windows, the web, and more.
But wait, there's more.
And there is, in fact, more. Lindsay, do you have another story?
Sure. There's robots that have become self-aware, quote unquote.
I, for one, welcome our new self-aware robot overlords. Just to put that out there. Okay, continue, Lindsay.
Right. I'm putting it out there, too. You are welcome. So roboticist Hod Lipson at Cornell University's Computational Synthesis Laboratory. Doesn't that sound fun? I want to go there. It says the greatest challenge for robots today is figuring out how to adapt to new situations, because you can, of course, program a robot to do just about anything, and then it just follows instructions. But if something happens that is not within its range of prediction, then it everything stops. Like if you're thinking of an assembly line or something like that, it's the whole wrench in the works. So the key for robots to create a model of themselves is to figure out what is working and what is not working in order to adapt. So he and a team of researchers created a starfish-shaped robot and gave it an idea what motors and other parts it had, but not how they were arranged. And they gave it a directive to move. And so by trial and error, receiving feedback from its sensors, it developed its own ungainly form of movement. Then they removed a leg, and over time it adjusted its self-image and learned how to move without that leg. They said that, interestingly, though, it had some phantom limb. They're saying that it had mental illness because it had phantom limb syndrome for a while after removing one of the limbs. But they worked with Juan Zagal at University of Chile in Santiago. And then the research team later developed robots that essentially reflect on their own thoughts. And they achieved this by thinking about thinking or metacognition by placing two minds in one robot. So one was a controller mind that was rewarded for chasing dots of blue light involving random circular patterns and avoiding red dots as if they were poisonous. And then they put the second controller, which modeled how the first behaved and whether or not the first one was successful, it would store that information. So the team swapped the rules of the game so that red was good and blue was bad, and saw how the robot reacted and how long it took it to readjust its behavior. And so when the second controller reflected on the first controller's actions, the second one could make changes to adapt to failures. So, for instance, it filtered sensory data to make red dots seem blue and blue dots seem red. And it said in this way, this robot adapted after just about 10 physical experiments instead of the thousands of physical experiments it usually takes using traditional evolutionary robotics techniques. So it's much faster adaptation.
Okay, so not quite self-aware, but definitely much more advanced than what had been there before. That's
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I take back my comment. Yeah, whatever. Self-aware robots. Yeah, whatever. You guys are pansies. I don't care.
Yeah, it's not aware enough for us to welcome them yet.
Yeah, you're not the boss of me.
Exactly.
So since we're going back into the tech world, and I'm just going to put a little note about plans for Internet Explorer 10. Well, wait, Internet Explorer 9 just came out. In fact, it was just released less than a month ago.
Yeah.
And one of the things about Internet Explorer 9 that made some waves was it's not available for XP. You have to have Vista and Windows 7 to run it. It turns out Microsoft is dropping Vista support for Internet Explorer 10. And they have a roadmap that says Internet Explorer 10 is going to be out in a much shorter form than it took for 9 to come out relative to version 8. So that seems like a really fast drop-off.
Yeah.
That seems like they're aggressively trying to push people into getting Windows 7.
Getting away from Vista.
Or more specifically, trying to get people off of XP and then trying to make sure they don't just sit on Vista and do a small little jump, like put the original disks back in their machine that they downgraded to XP.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you want Windows 7.
Yeah. My mom has a laptop with Vista on it, and she hasn't been very happy. And so she's like, how much will it cost me to upgrade this? And yeah, it's working. I'm like, definitely worth the upgrade.
Well, that's the funny thing, though, is that if you buy Windows 7 as a retail package, if you buy it separately, a separate product, it's actually pretty close to the price of a netbook that comes with Windows 7.
Right.
It depends upon the version that you have in there. But, I mean, it seems like it would be a non-trivial part of the overall cost of the machine. I've seen machines that were, you know, like less than $500, and seeing this copy of Windows 7 that's, you know, more than 20% of that cost, it's like, whoa, wait a second here.
Yeah. And normally, you know, that's what I'd say, but getting a new machine for my mom is a big, you know, she'd have to get readjusted to it and everything.
Yeah, but at the same time, if you buy a new machine, that copy of Windows 7 is not the same price. I mean, it's heavily discounted. It becomes bundled with it as an OEM package with that machine. And so it's the way that it's this weird dual universe. Like upgrading just the operating system is less cost effective than just buying a whole new machine.
Yeah, in some ways. Yeah.
Which then brings you back to the original story from this show, which was 70% of the cost is going to manufacturing.
Yeah, exactly.
Or of the electricity usage.
And you can get a new one for under $200 and use it as a server. Yes, indeed. So,
well, we have another call, and I'm going to take Valerie all the way from Bend, Oregon. Hello, Valerie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, I wanted to be able to work on my computer and watch a movie at the same time on my television through my computer. And so I switched my monitors on my computer so I could just watch it on the television, and then the screen wasn't fitting. So when I went to switch it back, I did something, and now my television screen is just black and it has no signal on it. So I don't know what I did.
Probably switch the input on the TV. If you look at the remote on your TV, there'll probably be a button that says input.
Yeah, it says source.
Yeah. If you press that a couple of times, it doesn't go back to your cable, assuming that your cable box is turned on.
Yes. And it comes up with the TV, AV1, AV2, PC, and I keep hitting TV and nothing's happening.
You still have your, I missed whether you said you still have your computer plugged in to the TV. Is it still plugged in, or did you unplug the computer?
Or more to the point, did you unplug anything when you were plugging your PC in?
My PC has been plugged in for, I mean, it's been connected for a long time. but I actually did, you know, unplug it just to see if that would clear it up. And it didn't, so I plugged it back in. But everything's still connected the way it was.
Do you have, how do you normally get it to play on your television? Do
so
you have
on,
like a function key?
On my monitor, on the display settings on the computer,
mm-hmm.
I'm in that screen and, you know, it says identify monitors. So number one should be like the highlighted one, right? If I just want it on my computer.
Usually, yeah. Usually number one is just going to be the computer. And then you have the option for choosing two. And then that would normally be your television. And so if you choose two, does it show a picture on your television again and the computer screen goes black, or do you see both?
Let's see.
Oh. I thought I lost you.
No. It's we're brainstorming as to what the possible solutions would be here.
Well, because it normally will say no signal if you're, you know, if they're plugged in. And you have the option to view your computer screen and or your television screen, either one at a time or both. And so if you have it selected so that you're only viewing your computer screen in the screen options, then the TV would say no signal. At least that's the way
Well, it depends on the TV. Some just right. are black, some are blue screen, some of them.
So on your computer, do you have a function key for the monitor? Like my computer, I use...
I'm just turning up black, and I can't hear what the woman is saying.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I turned my my speaker on, and I'm like, wait a minute, she's talking.
There we go.
Okay, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay,
sorry about that. That was my technical difficulties on Geek Speak.
So, do you have a function key that you normally press to switch between the computer and the TV, like function F7?
No, I've never done that.
On your computer keyboard, do you have anything like that that you see?
I have an F7, but I've never used it.
Well, wait, is this a desktop or a laptop?
It's a laptop.
Okay, well, it probably would have something that has an icon that shows, like, multiple monitors.
Do one of the function keys show multiple screens on the little function key, like a computer and a monitor?
The icons sometimes look very bad. They look kind of like two overlapping... Squares. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, there might be something like that. It doesn't have a F in front of it. It just has just an icon, so maybe that's...
Usually...
And chances are it's in a different color, and so you'd have to press a button at the bottom left-hand corner that's like an FN key that's like the same color as that icon.
Yeah, I see the icon is black, and it has... It's square with some little lines in it, and it has an arrow on it, so I can't really... tell exactly what it's for, but
has this happened to you before?
No, it hasn't. So my TV's not working because I pushed some wrong button.
There's the classic, turn everything off, turn everything back on, which is support 101. I don't know if you've tried that, but sometimes that'll reset the connection.
Yeah.
But right now you can't get your TV to display anything, even something from like a VCR, DVD player? Or...
The only thing I get is something like attention, no video input.
Okay. Unfortunately, you've tapped us out. Without actually seeing the setup, I don't know what more...
Yeah, but turn it off recommend. And turn it back on first if you haven't tried that.
I'd recommend finding a neighbor's teenager.
Right.
I know. The unfortunate thing is I moved up here and I don't know anybody, so.
Well, I would say, or my recommendation would be then make a group of cupcakes or get together like a sort of thing, a little care basket and, you know, go around, knock on the door, and say like, hi, I'm new to the neighborhood, and just introducing yourself, and then notice if there's some kid in the background playing an Xbox 360 or something like that, and then be like, oh, by the way,
yeah,
would you like to get your kid out of the...
I just realized that the input wasn't plugged into my computer, so I just have this beautiful picture of my grandson on my TV now, and I can't, that's the screen I can't get out of.
And what are you trying to get into? Other TV stuff?
Yes. Just trying to get back to my TV. And so the only thing that comes up is when I hit PC, my desktop is on my television.
Okay. So it is taking input, but it's just, does the remote work for other things? For, you know,
yeah, she was saying that it shows the different items that were there. Okay. It's, I would check the connections, making sure that the DVD player is still plugged in, making sure that that wire that goes from the DVD player to the TV is still plugged in and snug.
I was watching movies on my computer.
Mm-hmm. And you should still be able to do that since you're able to see your desktop, but you just won't, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I guess that's about as far as we can get with this.
Yeah.
But thank you for the call. Sorry, I hope you have the best of luck, and I hope you get to meet and hang out with your neighbors a little bit more.
Yeah, all right. Thank you so much. Right. It's always great to listen to you guys every week. I get a little piece of home.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Thwarted by the TV.
And we got an off-air message from Hal in Santa Cruz, who's a longtime listener and sometimes calls in. There's a thing called the Life Cycle Assessment, LCA, which apparently they fund a lot of studies on energy consumption for various devices. So if you want to know more, do a Google search for Life Cycle Assessment. And we'll put that information up on our website as well. Thank you very much, Hal, for that info. And now I think we'll move on to some more news.
All righty.
I think I'll take this next one.
All right.
Years ago, this was actually about the time that GeekSpeak was, or I was first doing GeekSpeak, along with Lyle, John, and Sean.
About
11 years ago or 10 years ago. Yeah, it was something like that. And we were talking about a XXX top-level domain, .xxx. So instead of a .com or a .org, there would be a .xxx. And there being a lot of resistance to it back in the day because it would lend itself well to someone who gets on that domain. You can then have places just say, we're going to block that whole domain, even if they are a consenting adult and want to see the things that are on there. And then comes a question of, well, if that's a domain that you have, for example, sexually explicit material or offensive material, then what happens to the other domains that are on .com or .org? Will you have pressure to move the ones that are already there? Mm-hmm. You know, will Playboy.com be forced to move over to Playboy.xxx or something like that? Will there be social pressure there associated with it? Well, we may soon find out what the answer to that question is, because .xxx has gone live on the root domain servers. Currently, there are no .xxx domains. There are several, or there are actually more than several. There's many pre-orders for it. People have reserved their domain, but none of them have gone live yet. And very soon, people will be able to put in, you know, some item .xxx and
And have a result.
Right. And very soon, I'm sure you're going to be seeing web filters, like, for example, for a company that we used to work for, had that as well, that will just simply do a blanket ban of anything that's .xxx. Yeah, that's right out.
I wonder if some domains are going to avoid having their sites there, because a lot of that is element of surprise, you know?
Right. Or for that matter, if a domain wants to have more exposure, then they would avoid that. And that's where I wonder about that social pressure to say, no, we're going to force you to go into a .xxx, or to say, why aren't you on .xxx?
But
even though DNS originally had the idea of .com was going to be commercial, .org would be a nonprofit organization, .net would be a community-based item, but that has fallen by the wayside. Like, no one, anything could be a .com, no matter if it's commercial or not. You have commercial entities that are .org. You have, you know, .net just shows up randomly at different places, and people have .biz and you know, all sorts of other ones. So there is no actual tie-in. There's no registration for that. And so I wonder about, would people try to push for that as you have this? Because people tend to make a special case for XXX. Like, in general, if you bring up sexually explicit material or, you know, things that many people consider offensive, that brings their hackles up more. They take a more strident interest in it,
mm-hmm.
One way or another. So,
like establishing their own country in the virtual domain out there. I wonder how that's going to go.
Right.
People are going to want to go there or go to there.
And who knows? It may be that the adult industry, from what I've heard, many of them have been embracing it, going like, hey, it's a great marketing thing, and I don't have to worry about, you know,
right.
with kids getting on there, because it's very clear what it's about. So it's the onus is not on us to do that verification. You can't just stumble upon it and not know what you're getting into.
Yeah, and I think that's good. I heard that it was banned in India already.
I'm sure it'll be banned in many countries around the world.
Yeah.
Do you have a geek bit for the day or anything that you wanted to bring up?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head other than Sharp has a 70-inch television out now. They are the reigning king and or queen, depending on...
There were already 70-inch TVs out there already.
69, but not 70.
So this is
70. And then supposedly LG is coming out with a 72, and you know, then they will have the crown. But that's the only thing that caught my eye.
Well, one thing I did come across the past couple of weeks, I saw it last week but didn't get a chance to cover it on air, was the fact that sorting algorithms are a mainstay of computer science. And but at the same time, they're an esoteric area. Sometimes it's hard to get people interested in them, and sometimes they're hard to understand. Well, there's a series of YouTube videos that have gone out that describe different sorting algorithms, bubble sort, quick sort, or I don't know if they've actually done quick sort, but shuttle sort, insertion sort, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, not shuttle sort. That's a quick sort variant. But they're doing it in the form of Hungarian dance.
What?
Yeah. So I'll put up a link to that as well. So that's actually
visual?
A fun thing to watch, just to know what those computer scientists were talking about, but still feel like you have your foot firmly rooted in the non-geeky world. You just want to dip your toe in the pool, as it were.
I can't wait to see that, how they do the dance thing. Did you see the thing where there was a student that thwarted face detection software using makeup? That was pretty neat. Figured out how it worked, put the makeup on backwards, and they were able to thwart all this face detection software, including all the stuff on, you know, Google for photos and things like that. It's pretty neat.
Well, we are coming to the end of our show. The Japanese Cultural Fair of Santa Cruz presents Help Japan, a concert and fundraiser for victims of the March 11th earthquake and tsunami in northern Japan at 7 p.m. Saturday, April 23rd at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz. Performers include San Jose and Watsonville Taiko groups, the Santa Cruz Hogakukai, and Ho'omana Hawaiian Band with hula dancers. Sandy Leiden will be the master of ceremonies. Tickets and information are available at jcfsantacruz.org. Car Talk on KSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at Community Foundation Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. Car Talk, of course, coming up next. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, and we're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. I'm sorry today that we will not get back to our third caller, John Boulder Creek. I hope that you call back for next week. Love to be able to get your call. Thank you so much, Lindsay, for joining me today.
Thanks, Miles.
It's been a pleasure. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm your host, Miles Elam, and we'll see you next week.